it's a secret to growth and evolution. Because sometimes you do things because you haven't got the choice. You have to go through those tough times and makes you realize that there are things that you never thought you could do and that you can achieve. And this is a huge achievement in itself.
Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, anthrozoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is they're awesome.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
So the shout out today goes to all of my listeners. Thank you all so much. I'm not going to list every single country because we're listened to now in over 70 countries and territories. Because we hit a download milestone this month, and in the same month, we're also having our 2-year birthday. Now, if you want to know what that download number actually is, it's not something I normally share. But if you want to find out that number, I did mention it on Twitter at TDWA Podcast, so you can go back and scroll through and find it there if you're super interested. But I tend not to share that number, because when I'm talking to people who want to start their own podcast, I don't want them focusing on the download number. And there's so many reasons for this. The biggest one is if you're doing a podcast, you're doing it because you love the topic. You're passionate about what you're talking about, and you're sharing your enthusiasm along with your mission, your message, your research, or your experience with your listeners. And that's what I try to do. That's what I'm invested in. And I'm having a good time doing it. Honestly, I would be doing it even if I didn't have download milestones, because for the few people I would be sharing my enthusiasm with, it's enough. I'm having a great time. You're having a great time. So to all the people who either dip in and out of the series as they like the topic that we're covering, or who listen to every single episode, whatever kind of listener you are, thank you so much for joining me in this 2-year point. It really is so fun to be able to share my enthusiasm for anthrozoology and all the ways in which humans and animals interact. Now, before we start Series 8, which if you listen to the trailer, you will know is all about the animal care culture and companion animal sheltering, you will also know that this episode is a special episode about the elephants of Tula Tula with Françoise Maltby-Anthony. She recently wrote a book of the same name, and I was so excited to read this book because, honestly, Françoise is living the life that I imagined for myself since watching the movie Born Free when I was 8 years old. And just as you would expect, she has amazing stories to share with us, not only about the elephants, but about rhinos and many other species, including the human ones that we share this world with. I'm so excited to be able to share this chat with you today, and I hope that you enjoy. Thank you for joining me as we try to answer the question, what's the deal with animals?
Would you please introduce yourself and share your pronouns?
Absolutely. My name is Françoise Maltby-Anthony, and I live in South Africa for 35 years now, and I run and own Tula Tula Game Reserve in KwaZulu-Natal, in Zululand. Voila.
So I admitted to Françoise that I hadn't yet had the time to read the entirety of the book, but now having done so, I'm glad I asked this question. Why did she write this book now?
Because, you see, my first book was An Elephant in My Kitchen, and my second book, the whole inspiration was An Elephant in My Garden. You see, I didn't call it An Elephant in My Garden. The story was about my matriarch, a very special elephant with whom I've had a very strange relationship, a love and hate relationship. I mean, it appears in my first book, and that second book, I decided to write it because of certain circumstances which happened to, frankly, my matriarch. And as well, it's a book which is about bringing awareness and bringing awareness about the situation of our wildlife in Africa. And because a lot of people don't know what's actually happening to wildlife, the terrible situation of poaching, human and animals conflicts. And I think it's good to bring that to the world. It's a educational, inspirational at the same time. It's a journey of discovery about the survival of African wildlife. And it's full of adventure, full of true stories, of course. It's the behind the scene of running a game reserve as well. A lot of people, you see, it looked, when people go on safari in a game reserve in Africa, it appears to be a dream life in the African bush with beautiful nature and wildlife. But actually, people must know the challenges that face wildlife and nature conservation. And this is what this book and all these learnings that I want to share with the readers. And it's all inspired by a very special herd of elephants.
Why don't you tell us a bit about Tulu Tulu Game Reserve, just to start with?
Yes, sure. Tulu Tulu Game Reserve, we bought it with my late husband, Lawrence Anthony. People might have heard about him. He wrote the very well-known Elephant Whisperer in 2009, and he passed away in 2012. We bought it in 1998, and it was a very run-down hunting game reserve. And we got that herd of elephants that we actually saved for being culled, for being put down, because they were problem elephants. And we got them in August 1999. And that was the beginning of our really incredible adventure. Those elephants, there were seven of them at that time. And now we've got a magnificent herd of 28 elephants. And we've grown from 1,000 hectares to, in a couple of months, we shall be 5,500 hectares. The whole purpose of that project of buying a game reserve, that was a dream of Lawrence, to create a vast game reserve where elephants could be roaming freely, no hunting, no culling, and animals could reproduce themselves and in all freedom, roaming freely in the wilds of Africa where they belong.
It's a beautiful idea.
That was his dream. And he passed away in 2012. And 2012, I took over on my own all his conservation work. I was in charge of we've got two beautiful lodges, you know, where tourists come for eco safari. I was running that, the marketing, the finance, the admin, etc. So from one day to another, and totally unprepared, I had to take over the wildlife and nature conservation side that Lawrence was working with. He was working with the animals. He was working with all this. So I was totally unprepared. So it was a very tough time for me, 2012. And it's been 11 years now, and things are fine. So the book is actually a book about all the challenges, all the obstacles, all the troubles we're going through. And it ended up like a success story. I think people like success stories. And so it's got a happy ending book.
Especially now. Well, that's good to hear since I haven't finished the book yet. I will look forward to the happy ending. It really is a dream, isn't it? To be able to live in Africa and take care of the wildlife. But from someone who myself started a animal rescue at one point, and mine was only for sheep. It wasn't for elephants. And sheep can be a lot of work. I can't even imagine what elephants and rhinos and all of that. Plus, nobody was trying to go around poaching the sheep. So that certainly is a whole different aspect to what's going on in it. And it really isn't the dream anymore at that point, right? There are a lot of difficulties in running any kind of animal rescue, and African wildlife animal rescue is going to be 10 times harder than anything we know over here in the States. So why don't you tell us about the difficult parts?
Yeah, it's a full-time job, as you say. Now, any animals is like having lots of children. Yeah, it's like having a big family to take care of. As a poaching, yes, this is something we have to bring more and more awareness of. The number of rhinos is diminishing because of poaching. Problem of poaching comes mainly from the Far East, where syndicate organize poachers in South Africa. And I must say that those poachers are driven because of poverty. They come and kill our rhinos. So we catch those rhino poachers sometimes. But unfortunately, they are not. It's like in the drug business. They're not always aware what's actually happening. The reason they're doing that for. Poaching is a drama. It's a tragedy for us. We had an orphanage for rhinos, which got attacked by... It's organized crime. You must understand. Rhino poaching is organized crime. And they came and they killed two of our baby rhinos. They were 18 months old. The size of a horn of a baby rhino. It's ridiculous. And killing two rhinos for this. So it was an absolute tragedy. The reason why they kill those rhinos for their horns, which in the Far East they believe has got medicinal values, and actually doesn't. So it's just ancient traditions. You see, nowadays the rhino horn is transformed into powder, and they mix it with cocaine, and they sniff it or they put it with as medicine, so whether it's for their sex life or to cure cancer. So all these beliefs, the strange beliefs, which are driving a species into extinction. And this is a drama that we have to fight with every single day. We've got five rhinos at Tula Tula, and we have them followed 24 hours a day, all five of them, by game rangers, by my anti-poaching team. We know where they are. We've got a WhatsApp group where we know where they are every half an hour. And it's just not only an insane amount of expenses, extra expenses. I mean, I think we've got cameras all over the game reserve, surveillance cameras. We've got drones. We've got planes from an organization called Project Rhino, which they come once a week to check. We've got our fences broken on a regular basis. So we live in fear of the poachers on a regular basis. When you think that three rhinos are killed every day in South Africa for their horns, then those horns are smuggled to the Far East. So it is something that people have got to be aware of, because as much as elephants as well, the ivory poaching, the elephants for ivories, it's starting in South Africa as well. And all these animals have been, the hippos as well, they've got ivory as well. Giraffes are being poached as well for their tails, and for lions are being poached for their bones. Everything for certain kinds, strange tradition, ancient tradition. And so this is what we're fighting against.
And let's just be clear that the rhino horns are made of what?
The keratin, just keratin. If you are biting your own nails or cutting your hair and chewing it, it has exactly the same value. So it's got no medicinal value whatsoever. But you know the problem that in China, 70% of the people are not informed or educated about that. They think that rhinos drop their horns like every year or something like that. And they just go and collect them in the field. They're not informed. So there's a big campaign done by WildAid in China to show videos of the massacre, the slaughter of rhinos, what actually happened to those rhinos, so that those people can use those horns. And education is a slow process. I just found out that my first book actually comes out in Chinese this month in China.
Oh, great.
It has been translated by an elephant in my kitchen, where there is actually the story of the tragedy of our rhino orphanage. So let's hope that education will get there eventually. It's a slow process, very slow. That's why in the meantime, we protect our wildlife the best way we can. Unfortunately, there are two ways for it. It's education and there is fighting. So we've got to do both. And we have to educate as well the people on the ground here in South Africa, the poachers. We have to educate them as well, to explain to them that today there is no more wildlife in Africa. Nobody will come to Africa on safaris. And then all the jobs in tourism industry and this game reserve. And there are so many wildlife reserves in South Africa, which have created so many jobs. So we try to explain to them the consequences, to have a bit of vision. The future, but it's difficult. It's not always easy to educate people who are hungry. That's a problem. It's a syndicate that we cannot catch. It's just like the problem of terrorism or the problem of the drug cartels. So it's the top people that we should catch. And these people, unfortunately, are inaccessible.
And you talk about in the book ways that you try to keep the rhinos and the elephants safe. And one of those ways was because you sometimes are raising these animals from babies and they're very attached to their human caregivers, they become used to human presence. And would that mean then if a poacher shows up, they just don't run away from the poacher? They aren't afraid? They don't defend themselves?
Well, we've got the two baby rhinos that you mentioned, is Tabo and Tombi. So they were two little orphans that we brought up from the age of 4 months and 8 months. They were orphans because their mothers got killed by poachers. And those two are habituated to humans because we brought them up and we fed them and we are with them all the time. Now they are in the wild, always followed, of course, by our rangers to make sure they are. They're habituated to humans, but a poacher comes walking next to a bovol Tabo, Tabo is our temperamental, delinquent teenager, and he doesn't like people on foot. So he probably would kill the poacher, so that would work well. My other rhinos are wild. They would run away. They would probably run away. But those poachers are the experience. But you know, we cut their horns every 14 months anyway. Our rhinos don't have horns anymore. We did a few years ago the poisoning of the horn, which was a very clever way. It was a great idea, but it didn't work. Because it's a poisoning that you drill the horn and the vet was inserting a poison inside the horn. So anyone sniffing or eating the horn as a medicine would get very sick. Hmm. But the problem is that the poachers didn't care. And they were still killing the rhinos because they didn't care. The people in the forest were dying or getting sick from a poison horn. So we decided in 2016 to start the dehorning of our rhinos, which is an operation we do every 14 months because the horn, just like nails and hair, grow again. So we've just done it in January. We're doing it next year in March. And it's a serious mission because by helicopter, veterinarian, and dart the rhinos from the air and then cut the horn. It's a very emotional moment, actually, to experience. Because you can see, some people don't understand, but we have to cut their horns. It's part of the protection for those rhinos. Mm-hmm. We don't have lions at Tula. We don't have big predators. So you see a horn. The rhinos use their horn for protection against predators. But we don't have lions at the moment. But even if we get lions in the future, we've got so much other game that the lions can eat. So I don't think they would attack a rhino anyway. So we go to great lengths really to protect them. So the cutting of the horn, the protection, the cameras, the anti-poaching teams. It's just a huge amount of effort that we have to do. We go to great lengths for this, yeah. And that's to save a species. As I say, three rhinos are killed every day. So more and more game reserves now coming to cut the horns of the rhino because that's what they're looking for.
What happens to the rhino horns after you've cut them?
Okay, so we've got our security team is present when we cut the horn. And as the horn is cut, the veterinarian inserts a little chip for DNA checking so that if the horn gets smuggled, they can trace where it comes from. And then our security team takes it to an undisclosed place, into a very safe place, far away from Tula Tula, and in a safe where it stays. For records. So we've got our provincial wildlife authorities come every year to count the horns and to check them to make sure that they are safe, etc., etc. So at the moment, we've got a lot. We've got a big quantity of horns in that safe. Yeah.
At any point, do the horns get destroyed so that people can't steal them or use them or be tempted
to? Well, we've got to ask authorization for this. We've got to ask authorization to cut them, to destroy them. We could do that. Yeah, it's something we could do. We haven't considered it yet, but because we shall never sell them, obviously, because the trade of rhino horns, it's not allowed with the countries of the Far East. It has been something that some rhino keepers have been waiting for, that rhino horn trade opens with the Far East countries so that all that money would go back to conservation. We could sell those horns. But you've got the people who are against that trade, to open that trade, because they feel that there will never be sufficient, in my opinion, there will never be sufficient amount of horn to satisfy the market. The market is huge. So they think, you see, people who are pro-trade, they think that it's going to stop the poaching. And the people who are anti-trade think it's not going to. So it's a dilemma. It's a problem. It's something which hasn't been resolved yet. There are tons of rhino horns in South Africa in storage, which could bring a huge amount of money in conservation if we were selling it to Vietnam, to China, to these countries which are eager to buy them. At the same time, the market would drop. This is a price.
Yeah.
Would drop probably. So I don't know. This is just something that...
It is a dilemma, isn't it? Because if you're selling those rhino horns, which, as you say, have no intrinsic value, they're simply what the value that the superstitious medicinal gets put onto them, then there really is no reason to sell them for anything. But if people want to buy them and you can... and you are cutting them from the rhinos and to protect the rhinos, it's a weird loop, isn't it? Because
it's very weird. Very weird.
Because
you see, if we accept to sell them, if the trade opens, if it's been voted in South Africa, we can trade them, then it goes against what we keep educating the people over there, telling them that it's got no medicinal value. So it's very weird. We keep telling them, educating them, saying it's got no value. Those rhinos are killed for something which could just cut your nails and cut your hair. It's got the same value. And then we go and sell them to them at a huge value because it would still keep a certain value for the horns. So I don't know. It doesn't make sense. It all doesn't make sense. At the same time, there was one of our biggest in South Africa. There's a rhino breeder, actually, he's got thousands of rhinos. And he's collected tons of rhino horns, of course. And he's selling his farm because he can't afford the security anymore for his farm. So there are thousands of rhinos to be sold now. So I don't know exactly what's happening there. But he's been waiting for the trade to open so that he would be able to afford, because it's true, the security. I mean, the anti-poaching, this is one of our biggest expenses.
Which you wouldn't need if people weren't buying the rhino horns anyway.
Exactly.
Right.
Because you see, if it dropped the value as well, it's a status symbol as well in those countries. You get rhino horn, it means like cocaine or like very expensive drugs. If it drops the value, we don't know what's going to happen. It's a bit of mystery. I know that in the 80s, I mean, that's what they did as well. They opened the trade for the ivory, but it didn't stop the poaching, unfortunately. You know that an elephant is killed every 15 minutes in Africa. Every 15 minutes, an elephant is killed. It's like seriously organized crime as well. But that's in more northern African countries. And it's dramatic because they arrive by helicopter and with machine guns, and they just shoot the whole herds. And it's a dramatic situation. And it's starting in South Africa, unfortunately, because a lot of those countries have lost so much of their wildlife, you know. There's 60% of the population of rhino elephants has disappeared in those countries. Some of these countries don't have rhinos anymore. Yeah. And the elephant population is dwindling totally. You know that elephants are on the endangered species since March 2020. So it's seriously, it's a serious problem, because if elephants disappear from the planet, it's going to create a huge ecosystem, huge problem to the ecosystem, because elephants are an absolute necessity for the ecosystem. They are the landscaper. They push trees so that other animals can survive. They dig water so that other animals can drink as well. That's part of the, I would say, the job of an elephant. But I mean, that's what they do, elephants. They create paths. They are amazing creatures. So seeing them being destroyed like that, it's really heartbreaking.
Absolutely. And we talk about cruelty, right? That you mentioned this also, is that there's a difference between human cruelty and what goes on in nature. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
I think that the most dangerous animal is the human anyway.
Yeah, I'm talking about, you had a story in the book about baby Lisa.
Yes. Yes, baby Lisa has a cruelty. That she got sick. It was an amazing story because I got a call at 6 o'clock in the morning by my game reserve manager telling me the hyenas have attacked our baby rhino. She was about 20 months old, I think, at that time. So we all rushed to the place. We called the vet, of course, and we had to dart the mother to so that the vet could examine Lisa. And she was never attacked by the hyena, but all the hyenas, which was extraordinary. That's what the instinct of animals, of wildlife. They were all around. They knew that she was going to die. And us humans, we think we know better. So we called the vet, we called the truck to bring her to the orphanage where she would be taken care of. But he said there was no attack from the hyenas at all. And he did some blood tests. We got the results very quickly. It was a virus. Within 24 hours, this very precious little rhino, she just died. And so that was extraordinary. How did the hyenas knew that she was going to die? It's quite extraordinary. You know, it's like a story that we had in 2004 with baby Tula. We had a baby elephant that she was next to the mother, and the game ranger came to tell us there's a problem with that baby. It's not standing on its feet. Just born, but not standing on its feet. Normally, baby elephant, like baby giraffe, they stand on their feet immediately and they can start suckling from the mother. This one couldn't. And the mother looked tired and dehydrated and so on. So we did a kind of a cowboy mission and went to fetch that baby elephant. And that baby stayed with us and we fed her. We took care of her. She had a malformation on her feet. And eventually we were able to make her stand and she could run around and so on. But you know that the herd never came to fetch her. The mother never came to fetch her. It was the strangest thing. They knew she wasn't going to make it. They got that knowingness. And us humans, we try to not go against nature, but we try to resolve a problem. You know that in a game reserve like us, we usually do not interfere with nature and with wildlife, despite its cruelty of certain animals killing its other. We do not interfere. Unless it's man-made cruelty, poachers, etc. So, but that time we decided to interfere because it was a baby elephant and so on. There was nothing we could do. She died. She died after 4 weeks, and we were also heartbroken. I think the cruelty in the wild, it's nature. It's nature. They can all die of natural causes, or what we call natural causes, like a disease is a virus, deadly virus. It can happen. And there is nothing we could do about it. We've got the story, of course, of our matriarch as well. We decide to interfere with nature as well. She was our matriarch, for God's sake. She was a very special lady, Frankie. And she used to come and see me all the time at the house. I mean, it was spectacular. And she was temperamental, but we loved her. And when she disappeared from the herd and isolated herself, we decided to interfere with nature. We didn't know what was wrong with her. The whole herd came on Christmas Day on a parade, and she was missing. And we didn't know what was happening. So we went to look for her. And she isolated herself. Why did she isolate herself? Maybe because the reason being, maybe she thought we could take care of her better because she was on her own, or maybe because she did that not to slow down the rest of the herd. And because she couldn't walk fast anymore, she had lost weight. You could see she was not well. So we called a vet. They came with a helicopter, dot her, took some blood samples, exactly like we did with baby Lisa. And it happened that she had a liver damage. And he said there's 50% chances that she makes it. So we took the 50% and we tried. We tried for 3 weeks. We fed her. We gave her some special food. We brought her food every day. And we tried. We tried. And after 2.5 weeks, she disappeared completely. She went to hide into the most secluded little water hole. And she decided that she was leaving this world. And we found her after a few days and we looked for her. So it's sure that you can look for elephants, they're big animals, but we couldn't find her. And when we found her, it was just she had decided to go on her own. And nature, that was nature taking her. She was only 46 years old. She was our matriarch. And you know, when a matriarch is like a leader, goes, who is going to replace her? And that was another dramatic situation. The whole herd changed completely, of the whole behavior changed. The herd was all dispersed all around the game reserve. There was not at all that unity that a matriarch works on. A matriarch is a leader and they work in unity, and they always together, they talk together. You can see them always. They're unbelievable that way. They work in unity for the greater good. And you could see that time they were, and that lasted for months and months until the new matriarch emerged. And that was a daughter of Frankie. And Frankie was a strong matriarch. She was 46 years old. The problem that the daughter, normally the matriarch is the biggest and the oldest female. But that one was not available. Let's say she was looking after her mother. Nana was our previous matriarch, because she's half blind. And so there was only that one left. And she was totally unprepared, just like me when I took over from Lawrence, the conservation work of Tula Tula. So I could see she was a little bit hesitant. But anyway, now she is a true matriarch. She's taken really the leadership of the herd, and she's doing extremely well. For a young, she's a young matriarch. And I think she's been observing her mother for years, and she is getting there slowly. And for once now, after 2 years, after the death of Frankie, we're starting to have again that same unity within the herd, which is quite wonderful. So nature is cruel, yes. It's always survival. You see, it's all about survival.
Yes, it's interesting how you separate out the idea of human cruelty, because it comes from this place of greed or this place of trying to take something. And whereas nature is not so cruel, but just as, I don't know, is there another word for it than cruelty?
Well, no, I don't know. I'm trying to find a word for this. It's nature of I don't know. It's difficult. It's the cruelty of the wild. I think it's nature. It's a heartbreaking life in the wild. It's just something. I don't say that any animal disappearing is heartbreaking, but when you start counting them because their numbers are diminishing every day, it's very sad, because a rhino is very precious.
You did say it well just then, that it's heartbreaking, but it is nature. It's part of nature. And there is a reason for it, even if it's not one that we like to accept.
Yeah, exactly.
As humans, we like to fight against that.
It's a bit like the same with humans. Nature is the same thing for some humans die younger, and it's always tragedy as well when they die before their age.
And we're always going to fight against that, aren't we? We're going to fight against human cruelty, but we do also fight against this, because I think it's in our nature to do that. We do try to, as much cruelty, human cruelty as there is in the world, we do try, there's just as many people, if not more, who are trying to combat that cruelty through doing things like wildlife reserves and trying to mitigate the human impact on nature.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. But humans like us, I mean, we show empathy, of course, empathy, because as I say, we do everything that the animals reproduce. An interesting story about reproduction of animals. You know that rhino Tabo, we had some tests done on him because we've been waiting for him to make babies. He's 13 years old now. Actually, he's 14 years old this year. And we've been waiting for him to make babies, Tabo. Was 1 day old when he was found. He was only 1 day old. So when he was found in a game reserve somewhere in South Africa, and he was taken to an orphanage up north in Limpopo, in Mpumalanga. And he was brought up by humans. I mean, the first creatures he saw were humans because his mother was killed straight away. And he was found, he still had his umbilical cord actually attached to him. So that rhino was just brought up by humans. Then we introduced Ntombi. She was 8 months old. She was a little bit more wild than him. But her mother was killed when she was 5 months old, Ntombi. And Tabo and Ntombi became inseparable. They were our little orphans, their little babies. We fed them, we took care of them, we protected them, and so on. We've been waiting for them for so many years to make babies. Eventually, we had some veterinarian who came and did tests on Ntombi and Tabo, some really very elaborate test of fertility. And we found out that our Tabo was totally sterile. So what's very interesting, and what the veterinarian said, he said it's a very interesting thing which happens to a lot of rhinos who've been brought up in orphanage or who've been brought up as orphans, comes from the traumas from the past. Very interesting. And for Ntombi, for the female, he did some special operation on her. It's a little bit technical. I don't want to go into details. And now she can produce babies. So because of her as well, she couldn't produce babies. So it just shows what trauma do to animals, just like humans. And so now what we did in 2019, because we thought that Tabo maybe didn't want to make babies with Ntombi, we got him a new girlfriend. A nice girlfriend was wild and experienced. She had already had babies. So we got her. We called her Mona. Well, she was the mother of Lisa. And then when Mona arrived, Tabo was not interested. So we just thought we've got a problem with Tabo. So eventually in December, after we did the fertility test on Tabo, we decided to get a male rhino to make babies to our females. And we called him Rambo. And he arrived in December, a year and a half ago now, and Rambo has been very busy. So we think we're getting babies by the end of December this year. Baby rhinos. So Rambo has been, he's been very busy. Tabo is very confused. Doesn't know what's happening. So we've got like a soap opera, love story, soap Tula Tula, which I think they're very funny, the stories about our rhinos. The love stories, the love triangle, quite funny. Yeah. Otherwise, So this is nature as well. This is a magnificent specimen like Tabo can never reproduce, which is a great pity. But we've got two females and three females, actually. And so we've solved the problem. So here as well, human interference, you see, because we had to do something about it for the greater good.
Françoise has shared so many interesting stories with us, so let's find out what she thinks we should read next.
If there was a book that you could gift to all of the listeners, what would that be?
Yeah, I've got my little Bible book, which is called, it's from Robin Sharma, and it's the monk who sold his Ferrari. And it's been a book that I read and I read again and I read again. It's a book which just opened my eyes about the good, about challenges, about survival and adversity. And this is actually something, a book which helped me as well, even during COVID, for example. You know that the tourism industry was extremely, has been terrible. The
yes.
tourism industry, hospitality industry, I mean, no tourists for months and months and no income, but huge expenses because we had to carry on. It is something which was an inspiration. That book was a true inspiration for me. And it taught me that as well as COVID, that the secret to survival, the ability to adapt to a new situation, and that pressure, challenges, and adversity opens the doors to new opportunities and our necessity for evolution and growth. You see, and Robin Sharma's book, when I read it a few years ago, it just opened my eyes, a change of life that this guy experienced because he got very sick. He got a heart attack, and then he changed his life completely with all the many challenges that he had to endure, and that to become an absolutely amazing success story. And I just love that book. Voilà, this is a book, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. It came out long, long time ago. That is one of my favorite books, of course, the most inspirational book I've read. But I like all the books of Robin Sharma, of course. I'm a big fan of him.
That's excellent. Thank you so much for sharing that one. And now, I'd like to ask you to share another story, but this one of your early childhood, or maybe your first memory of your connection with animals.
My first connection with animals was my first real connection with animals was with the matriarch Frankie. Because as a child, I never had a dog, or I didn't have pets. Or I started having pets when I came to South Africa, and of course, pets. I mean, I'm a big supporter of Adopt Don't Shop. I've got 8 rescue dogs at Tula Tula, and they're all just wonderful. But my real, you want a serious experience with an animal? Well, my first experience was Frankie, when she almost killed us with my late husband, Lawrence. They had just been taken out of the boma, that electrified fence where you have to put the animals so that they can get accustomed to their new environment. And we had just released them. They were problem elephants that we, with Lawrence, we didn't understand why. They just didn't have any trust in humans. And we were with Lawrence on a motorbike, and we literally bumped into the herd of elephants, 7 of them. And Frankie came forward. We were on a 4-wheeler motorbike, and Frankie came right on top of us, was about to kill us. And that was my first real encounter with a big animal, an elephant, a 4-ton animal who's about to kill you. It was the end of my life. Actually, at some stage, I closed my eyes, say goodbye. That's it. We're going to leave now. We're going to leave this planet now because we're going to be completely squashed down by this big, very angry elephant. And that's where my late husband, Lawrence Anthony, had an amazing reaction. He stood on the motorbike and he said, "It's okay, it's me." And Frankie just looked at him and said, oh, it's you. Because Lawrence spent a lot of time with the elephants when they were in that boma for about 10, 12 days. And he get them food with my rangers and so on. So they got used to his voice. They got used to his smell. And that's how my little husband saved us from sure death. Because when you meet an angry elephant, I promise you, you remember that moment for the rest of your life. So that was a great, an amazing encounter. Also, the encounter with other animals, I've got quite a few stories. So my life of animal with animals has been something which started in South Africa. And now it has become my passion.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I can't imagine, an elephant of that size, an animal of that size, deciding that it wants to kill you. There's really very little that can stop it unless it changes its mind. So,
exactly. It was quite something, quite an experience. Yeah, that you never forget.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So, what do you think is the deal with animals?
What do I think this deal with animals? You know, the deal with animals is my life with animals. It's a life of passion. with a roller coaster of emotions. It's a life of significance, you know, trying to make a difference and to make a better place, not only for animals, but as well for humans. You see, there must be a balance, humans, animals, and the conflicts human animals, unfortunately, are busy destroying the animals because there is a, we live on a human animals dominated world by humans. And unfortunately, but otherwise, living with animals, living in nature, do you know what I find? I find that a lot of humans have disconnected from the natural world. But we are all part of nature. We share the same planet. And we need to cohabit and to coexist. We need to educate humans and teach them about respect. You know, I think that animals are, the intelligence of animals is beyond humans' understanding. And this is something that humans must become more and more aware. And so it's a life, as I say, of passion and facing every day the reality and challenges of running a game reserve. It's all about survival. And I love that, actually, that sentence from Robin Sharma, who said passion is a secret to persistence. So it's about never giving up, believing about the impossible, and never stop learning. And these are all the, above all, believing in the impossible, always moving on, believing into staying positive and strong all the time, despite all the adversity of life and the challenges, the obstacles. There's another little thing that I love. It's that obstacles do not block the path. They are the path. And it's something that's very inspirational for me, I think.
Yeah, that is beautiful. They're the whole point of why we're here, aren't we, those obstacles?
Exactly. Exactly. And you go through those obstacles, it makes you grow. And it's a secret to growth and evolution. Because sometimes you do things because you haven't got a choice. You have to go through those tough times and makes you realize that there are things that you never thought you could do and that you can achieve. And this is a huge achievement in itself.
Thank you so much. And thank you for being here today and helping us to understand a little bit more about the realities of life on a game reserve and trying to protect the wonderful wildlife that all of us want to see continue in this world, but yet often don't know what we can do about it ourselves. And knowing that there are people who can do things about it very physically like you are is really amazing. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marika. It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you.
That was Françoise Mulby-Anthony sharing with us stories about her new book, The Elephants of Tula Tula. I hope you enjoyed this discussion and join us again in 2 weeks for the first episode of Series 8, Animal Care Culture and Companion Animal Sheltering. And just so you don't forget, why not go to thedealwithanimals.com and sign up for our monthly newsletter? You'll get episode insights and behind-the-scenes details and all the links you need to guest book recommendations and everything else. Thank you for joining me as we try to answer the question, what's the deal with animals?
I'm your host, Marika Bell. I'd like to thank Kai Stranskoff for the theme music and Natasha Matsar for help with editing. You can see links to guest book recommendations as well as their websites and affiliated organizations in the show notes and at thedealwithanimals.com.
This podcast was produced on both historical tribal land of the Snoqualmie and Quinault Indian Nations. Deal with Animals is part of the IROAR Animal Podcast Network.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?